My name is Oksana Vinorovska. I'm a partner of Vasil Kisil and Partners, a local Ukrainian law firm. And I'm a partner in private client group doing all kind of international private work for my clients. You know, in these challenging times, it's difficult to say or difficult to know if we are at the end of the beginning or beginning of the end of this pandemic. But notwithstanding this dilemma, I would like to welcome everyone at this virtual Kyiv IFL conference. I have to admit that I really enjoy the IFL and the IFL conferences being a great community of highly professional and very friendly people. Now I'm going to introduce briefly my brilliant panelists. And the first would be Roxane Reiser, originally from Geneva. Roxane was called to the Bar of England and Wales in 2017. She's a tenant at One Hare Court Chambers in London and an associate member of the Etude de Mai and Racer in Geneva. She's admitted to practice at Geneva Bar, and she specializes in financial remedy proceedings. She is regularly instructed to act in cross-border matters, raising issues of recognition, jurisdiction and enforcement both within and outside the European Union. Fluent in French and German, she often advises and represents French and German speaking clients divorcing in England. Sylvia Felix Kubikova from Czech Republic. Sylvia is the head attorney and managing partner in law firm Kubikova Legal, based in Prague, Czech Republic. Sylvia specializes in complex cross-border cases and international private law. Given her international background and multilingual skills, she trends cases involving foreign jurisdictions. Sylvie represents the interests of clients and their families in all matters of family law, and further specializes in civil litigation, commercial law, corporations, real estate transactions, civil law, property law, inheritance law, and contracts. Our third panelist, Chiara Matthews from Ireland, is a partner with Gallagher Shatter Solicitors, with a special focus on family law. She is recognized as a leading practitioner in the area of family law and has over 22 years experience in all aspects of family law, with particular experience in complex high value asset judicial separation and divorce cases, many with an international dimension. She is regularly consulted in complex custody and asset marital and non-marital disputes, including parental alienation, child abduction, and relocation cases. She's consulted in adoption cases, both domestic and intercountry. She's an author and editor of the Irish Family Law Precedents Services book, published by Thomson Roundhall. She lectures in the Law Society of Ireland, the Dublin Solicitors Bar Association and Family Lawyers Association in the areas of family law, adoption, and pensions in the family law context. And finally, Galina Kranslova, my colleague from Ukraine. I enjoy the acquaintance with. Galina took her degree at Zaporizhia National University and was admitted to the bar in 2010. She's a partner at Astor's law firm, having previously been head of family law practice at YEPAP Ukraine. Galina focuses on family law litigation, including cases involving the challenging of paternity, terminating of parental rights, adoption and custody, applying for child benefit and child support payments, determining child visitation and residence in court, divorce and property division proceedings, including division of shares in legal entities with the involvement of both resident and non-resident individuals. We are going to speak today about the maintenance, covering both the issues of support of the spouses and children. Where we are now, where we're going, actually, I would encourage the audience to make our webinar more alive, more active. I would like to encourage the audience to put the questions in a Q&A bottom. So after the speech of each or during the speech of each panelist, so we could answer the questions to our panelists in the course, within the course of the our session. If you want to put the question to some particular jurisdiction at the end of the session, you can also do that, but please put the name of the country. Again, here we are from England, Ireland, Ukraine, and Czech Republic. Just put remark which country your question is referred to. So I would like to invite Roxanne to be the first on the panel. We are hearing you.
Thank you very much, Oksana. Thank you everyone for joining. In this presentation, I'm going to focus primarily on spousal maintenance, and I will end with a note on child maintenance. For those who are particularly interested in child maintenance, then I suggest that you refer to the handout, which is available online for this presentation. Spousal maintenance. Why spousal maintenance? Well, first, because I believe that there is a gradual shift both in social and judicial attitudes towards spousal maintenance in England. And second, because it is in general hyper contentious. Husbands don't want to remain financially tied to their bipolar ex-wives, although funny enough, as you might expect, bipolar ex-wives don't have too much an issue in being tied to their what they would call narcissistic husbands for a very long time. So these are the sorts of adjectives and arguments that get thrown around in maintenance battles in England, and I'm sure in many of the jurisdictions in which you practice. So I will turn first to the principles governing spousal maintenance in England. The court has an almost completely unfettered discretion to award spousal maintenance to divorcing spouses. The court will have to take into account all of the circumstances of the case, including income, earning capacity, and the standard of living. The assessment of maintenance is driven by needs, although, as we are often reminded by British judges, needs doesn't mean needs. Needs can pretty much mean anything depending on the judge on the day. So we're often told this is a term of art, which isn't particularly helpful when you're trying to advise a client, but there we are. So exactly what quantum is, what needs is, very much depends on the judge and on the circumstances. Now, when it comes to the term of spousal maintenance, there is no mandatory term to spousal maintenance in English law, although the court has a duty to consider whether a clean break is feasible and whether the receiving party can adjust to the termination of maintenance without undue hardship. Again, query exactly how undue hardship is to be interpreted on a case-by-case basis. This is also one of these things that largely depends on the judge, whether they've had lunch when they're hearing your case, what sort of night they have had. So it is something which is highly discretionary. Orders for spousal maintenance can be open-ended, this is often called joint lives orders, or they can be a set term, and that set term can be extendable or non-extendable. So I will now turn to what I believe is the gradual, and I very much say gradual, shift in attitudes towards spells on maintenance in England. First, there is, in my view, a clear judicial preference towards term orders, i.e. orders with a set term, and then the burden falls on the person who wishes to extend the term to come back to court, as opposed to having an open-ended order where the burden is on the person, generally the husband, who wants to turn off the tap to come back to court and say, no, time out, I can't do this anymore. It's interesting to compare a Court of Appeal decision of CNC in 1997, where the Court of Appeal says, well, in doubt, if you're not sure whether the spouse is going to be able to adjust without undue hardship, then you have to make an open-ended order. And if you compare this with a more recent decision of Kwan and Bray at first instance, where Mrs. Justice Mustin says, no, joint life orders should be exceptional. Exactly where between those two extremes you're likely to alight on a given case, as I said, is largely dependent on the judge and on the facts of each case. But I think there is definitely a preference towards term orders and for those orders, those terms to be shorter rather than longer. I also flag the fact that there is currently a bill in the House of Lords, which is due to have its second reading, the Divorce Financial Provision Bill, which proposes a 5-year term to spousal maintenance unless it can be clearly shown that the person cannot adapt without spousal maintenance. There has only been one reading in the House of Lords, query whether the second one is in time anytime soon, but that bill exists. When it comes to quantum, there is, in my view, a clear expectation that both spouses should maximise their earning capacity, even in cases where they are children, particularly as those children get older. Now, why the shift? I think this is due largely to the rise of dual career couple and of the growing role of women in the workplace. And this is no surprises. I can tell you that from most of my friends at university, we're all earning more than our boyfriends and we're all talking about prenups. this should come as no surprise in some ways. What's also interesting is that I can, certainly from my practice, more and more I see cases where it's not the wife, it is the husband who's asking for maintenance. And I can tell you that women find the idea of paying maintenance to their penniless husbands just utterly repugnant. In fact, possibly more so than husbands. Similarly, it's also interesting to know that judges, male and female alike, tend to take a dim view of sort of autistic and mildly depressive husbands who say they can't possibly adjust without maintenance. So it's interesting to see these shifts in attitudes, judicial but also social, because it reflects, I think, just the difference in the way in which gender roles are now being conceived in relationship between men and women. And then there are other shifts. I don't know whether they are shifts or simply reflections of the judges' individual personalities. But for instance, female judges tend to be harsher on women. That's my experience. And that's often the same sort of thing in chambers, in our professional environments, when we must say, no, I've had to work so hard, so you know, you too, you should be working so hard, you know, get on your bike and do it. Whereas very often if you're in front of a sort of old-fashioned judge, oh, you know, how could she possibly return to work when the children are, you know, 12 and 15 and 18 or what have you. All of these factors sort of get in the mix. But I think as things progress and as those older judges come to retire, ultimately we are going to be in a situation where judicial attitudes towards maintenance are far more restrictive than they currently are at the moment. And I say this, I should caveat that by saying that this isn't so-called normal cases, right? In high and ultra net worth cases, we're talking about a completely different scenario. And I think that enormous orders are going to continue to be made in those particular cases. Now, I believe I have a couple more minutes to talk very quickly about China maintenance. The only thing I will say about China maintenance is that in low to medium income cases, China maintenance is determined by a government agency, the China Maintenance Service. And the China Maintenance Service is going to assess the quantum of China maintenance payable based on the party's income and the number of overnight contact per week that the parent is spending, the non-resident parent is spending with the children. In higher income cases where the payor is earning £12,000 gross plus, the court has jurisdiction to step in and to make an order beyond what the CMS would award. This is called a top-up order. And in both cases, however, the court has jurisdiction to make specific orders in relation to school fees or expenses related to a child's disability. So this is the framework within which China maintenance operates in the UK. If you, I should caveat that by saying that this is only in UK proper cases, i.e. where both parents and the child are resident in England, where one of the parents is not resident in England, then the CMS does not have jurisdiction. So the court will have jurisdiction. And when the court has jurisdiction, it will base its assessment once again on needs. And that concludes my presentation. I will take questions if there are any.
Yes, Roxanne, we have two questions to you. If you are able to read the question, please go ahead. If not, I could read it for you. The second question is quite interesting because I think it's about a particular case.
Yes.
Can you please describe us, for those who are not practicing in England,
yes,
just what is that case about and why that's interesting?
But yes.
I would be great if you could cover both questions, of course.
All right. So first question, Derek Parsons. How receptive has Roxanne found the courts to tapered term orders? Right, so the way I understand this question is, so term orders, I'm assuming with a decrease in the quantum of maintenance payable. If this isn't what you mean, Derek Parsons, please clarify. It's difficult. I think that the problem with a step down order, spot on, okay, great. The problem with a step down order is that when you are at trial, the figures that the court is presented with are the current figures. So it's the figures that of what the parties are currently earning. And sometimes the court is being asked to taper down an order on the basis that, oh, well, but, you know, yes, wife is earning this now, but in 5 years' time, she will be more senior in her role and therefore she could be earning X. The problem with that is that it requires the court to make a prediction when it doesn't have any hard evidence, if I can call it that way, to do so. And if it doesn't have any hard evidence to do so, then obviously that makes the particular judge vulnerable to an appeal, because it will be said, well, you know, why on earth did you alight on that figure? Did you order that step down when, you know, you just thought, well, maybe that's reasonable. So in my experience, the judges are anxious about making either orders that go up or orders that go down based on intangibles. So the assessment as to your earning capacity, or perhaps predictions about earnings going back to where they were after the pandemic. That's something that I see quite a lot at the moment. People who have a trial, and obviously everyone has depressed incomes because either they've been on furlough or they've lost their job, they've had to start afresh, et cetera, et cetera. And one of the spouses is saying, well, hang on a second, you know, this person is going to go back and earn in the future again. So you judge should be making an order at that level, even though at the moment that's not where the income is. Okay, further question. Without tapering, we would have a fiscal cliff. Okay, if a five-year answer is adopted by Parliament, do you expect less wives in cross-border distributable trust to get divorced than London courts? That's a question by Olga. She's asking whether, if the five-year rule is introduced, will wives in cross-border dispute will try to get divorced in London court a bit less, perhaps? I think yes, probably. Probably. I think, but the big problem, well, the big question mark is going to be exactly how that part of the divorce bill is going to be interpreted, because it doesn't say it's 5 years and then that's it. It says it's 5 years unless one can demonstrate that the party in question cannot possibly adapt. I mean, that's not the way it's phrased, but that's along those lines. So the real issue is going to be how that second part is going to be interpreted. So, you know, then I think it's largely going to depend on the resource of the particular party, because with people who have endless resources, they might think, well, I may as well have a crack at it. And just go and say, well, you know, I'm terribly destitute. My husband is mega rich, and I can't possibly adapt. And again, what's going to be interesting is to see how the court is going to apply the concept of needs, which, as I said, is completely elastic, and apply it to these sorts of cases. All right, I think I might have overrun slightly. I will type answers to the other questions later in the chat box. But thank you very much, everyone.
Okay, thank you, Roxanne, very much. And now, Sylvie, the stage is yours.
Thanks, Oksana. So my task today is to get you all acquainted with maintenance under Czech law. So at the beginning, just very briefly, what types of maintenance do we have in the Czech Republic? The Czech law establishes the obligation to maintain and support primarily between relatives in direct line, which basically means between ancestors and descendants. And then on top of this, we do have also obviously a maintenance obligation between spouses. So all ancestors and descendants always have a mutual duty to maintain and support each other. However, there is no maintenance obligation of in-laws, nor maintenance obligation within the collateral line of relatives, for instance, between siblings, between cousins, aunts, uncles, nephews, nieces, and so on. And then we also have one very specific maintenance obligation, which would be the maintenance of unmarried mother. So even though in practice you would find really a lot of combinations of relations where maintenance obligation exists, in practice, there are four most frequent maintenance obligations which are sued and which are paid and claimed, which is the child maintenance, obviously. This would be the most common cases. And then there are three runner-ups, which would be maintenance between spouses, maintenance between ex-spouses, which is a very different category under Czech law, and then the maintenance of unmarried mother. So let's see briefly within the time I have what each maintenance means. So first, child maintenance as the most common type. So how do we calculate child maintenance in the Czech Republic? To determine the extent of maintenance, courts, and it's always courts, so either there would be an agreement between parents, and every time when there's no agreement, it is court who has jurisdiction to decide. So we have no special agency, just like, for instance, Roxanne was mentioning in England. So for us, it's directly the courts. So the court must assess on the side of the entitled party, meaning the child in this case, the court must assess the justified needs and also the financial and property situation of the child. And on the other hand, or on the other side, the court must assess when it comes to the obligated party, which means the parents, their abilities, potential, and financial and property situation. On top of this, there's also the criteria which says that the standard of living of a child is to be identical to the standard of living of his parents. So it means that the child is not only entitled to maintenance to cover his objective needs, but if the standard of living of a parent enables it, the maintenance is calculated in a higher level to allow the child to participate in the standard of living of the parent. So this would be the basic criteria under Czech Civil Code. As you can see, we have general criteria. It means we don't have any exact mathematical formula to calculate maintenance in the Czech Republic. We only have these general, let's say, flexible criteria. It does bring both advantages and disadvantages, obviously. On the negative side, when there's no exact mathematical method to calculate maintenance, as it exists in some jurisdictions, it is sometimes difficult to assess the situation, and especially to give clients a reasonable estimate of how much should be paid or how much they might claim on behalf of the child. Also, it means that the case law may vary, because two courts may actually assess the very same situation quite differently. So the foreseeability of the decision-making may be problematic. However, on the bright side, when the criteria are general, it also means that you can take into account much more than any exact mathematical formula enables. So the final outcome, the maintenance amount, can reflect much more accurately the situation of the family in question. Given that discussion between the advocates of the exact methods and the general criteria are never-ending, in 2010, the Czech Ministry of Justice prepared an analysis of child maintenance case law, which also included recommended scales of maintenance calculated based on the net income of the obligated parent. So it basically said that at this age, it should be such percentage from the net income of the obligated parent and so on. However, this chart has never been really widely accepted, because as much as it might be helpful in some cases, but on the other hand, it doesn't really enable you to reflect all the variables of each family situation. So it means that not even among the judges it was really accepted, and now you may find cases when the judge might use it, but it is only a guideline, it is only a tool, it's recommended, it's not obligatory. So we are back at the situation where we have general criteria and we don't have any exact calculation mathematical methods. What I believe also is very important to mention when it comes to child maintenance in the Czech Republic is that so far I've been mentioning a child. I have not been mentioning a minor child. And this, I did it on purpose, because everything I've mentioned about child maintenance applies to children in general. So we don't have any age limit or generally time limit until when a child may claim maintenance from his or her parents. As long as there's the main criteria which needs to be met, which means that the entitled party, so the child in this case, is not too able to maintain himself or herself, judged by objective standards. So obviously, the older the child, the more it is likely that he or she will objectively be able to maintain and support herself. But generally, even if a child over 18 would be claiming maintenance, as long as it would be typically a student, or it would be he or she would be in any situation when he or she would not be able to support and maintain himself or herself, it is legitimate and legal to claim maintenance. So there would be really no age limit or time limit at all. So this would be very basic about child maintenance. Now let's move on to spousal maintenance. You may compare it more with what Roxanne was saying, who dedicated more to spousal maintenance. So it is very important to point out that in the Czech Republic, there's a huge difference between spousal and ex-spousal maintenance. So in terms of spousal maintenance, spouses have a mutual obligation to maintain and support each other. And both spouses shall have the same standard of living, which is the main criteria defining the extent of the maintenance obligation between spouses. It is important to point out that unlike other types of maintenance in the Czech Republic, the fact whether or not the entitled party is able to maintain himself or herself is not taken into account when it comes to spousal maintenance. So the mutual spousal maintenance obligation exists regardless of the financial dependence between the spouses. Even if both spouses are able to maintain and support themselves, as long as they don't have the same standard of living, the maintenance obligation exists. So this would be the major difference, because with all other types of maintenance, there must be the situation that the person claiming or entitled to maintenance is not able to support himself or herself, which doesn't take it, which is not taken into account when it comes to spousal maintenance. What is important to mention as well, or interesting, I believe, is that there's no maintenance obligation between unmarried couples in the Czech Republic. The Czech Republic only distinguishes between married couples and unmarried couples. We do not have any middle form of relationships like you'd have pacts in France, for instance, or common law marriage or any other, let's say, middle form. So either in the Czech Republic you are married, or for same-sex couples registered, and then you are entitled to maintenance. Or you are single, and it means even if you, for instance, cohabit with your partner for 23 years, you don't have maintenance obligation, nor you are entitled to maintenance mutually. So in practice, the spousal maintenance is very, very little claimed. The fact is that it normally the couples live together and so they do not claim maintenance against each other. So this would mainly apply in practice when the couple already broke up. And so for the period after the breakup and until the divorce, it might be beneficial for the spouse who has lower income or generally who has worse financial and property situation to claim maintenance. And this brings us to what happens after divorce. So, as mentioned, a huge difference in terms of what a divorced spouse is entitled to after divorce in terms of maintenance. So, just to remind you, during marriage, the same standard of living applies to both parents, and the entitled party has right to maintenance regardless of their ability to support themselves. When you divorce, this changes dramatically because we're quite harsh, I'd say, on divorced couples or divorced spouses. We encourage them to maintain and support themselves and not to depend on the ex-spouse, which means that there are several quite strict conditions which have to be met in order for an ex-spouse to be entitled to ex-spousal maintenance. So the conditions are the following. At first, again, the divorced spouse is unable to support himself or herself, which must be judged by objective standards. So it's not just a subjective condition of the ex-spouse. But then also, such inability to support originated in or in connection with the marriage. So it means we're not speaking about general inability of the divorced spouse, but there must be causal link between the marriage and the inability to support himself or herself. And then thirdly, also, there must be legitimate reasons to obligate the other spouse to pay the maintenance to the spouse who's claiming it. So as you can see, there's quite a lot of space to find exceptions or to find cases where ex-spousal maintenance would not apply. So typically, when a person would be entitled to ex-spousal maintenance in the Czech Republic, we have two typical situations. So first, in the situation of divorce of a shorter marriage, divorced mother taking care of minor children of low age would be a typical example of a person entitled to ex-spousal maintenance if she cannot work because she's taking care of the children. But still, we speak about kids who would be of really low age, because as soon as they can go to nursery school, obviously the wife could, or the woman or the man could work, and so that would no longer entitle them to ex-spousal maintenance. Second typical example would be if we mention the situation of a longer marriage where the children are already older. So the typical person entitled to ex-spousal maintenance would be the spouse who had not been working during marriage and dedicated himself or herself to the family. So such person may have lost its professional qualification during the course of marriage and therefore would need some time to recover the professional ability and rejoin the professional market after divorce. So also in such a case, under Czech law, it would be legal and legitimate to award such person with ex-spousal maintenance. But in terms of extent of ex-spousal maintenance, The divorced spouse is only entitled to receive an adequate amount, says the Czech Civil Code, which means that the other spouse must only contribute to cover the basic needs of the entitled party. So if you compare it with the same standard of living, which is the criteria for the spousal maintenance, after divorce for ex-spousal maintenance, you only get a contribution for your basic needs. So obviously the standard goes very, very low. And just a quick note, because I believe I'm running out of time, just to mention the specific type of maintenance we have in the Czech jurisdiction, which is the maintenance of unmarried matter. So the law, the Czech Civil Code, takes into account the fact that generally maintenance, only the right to maintenance, only comes from relations, from family relations or from marriage. But obviously you may have situations where women would not be married. So in such a case, if the child's mother is not married to the child's father shall provide the mother with maintenance. This maintenance is strictly limited for the period of 2 years from the birth of the child. And also the child's father must provide the mother with an adequate contribution to cover costs associated with pregnancy and childbirth. Again, it only is an adequate contribution in terms of the extent of the maintenance, and it is limited for 2 years after the birth of the child. But still, it's at least some protection for unmarried mothers. So that would be it for a general overview. Obviously, if there are any questions, I'll be happy to ask to reply to them.
Yeah, Sylvia, we have one question to you. So, or I think that you have 2 minutes, 3 minutes to reply.
Yes, sure. Let me see.
Olala is the first.
Yeah. Can maintenance, whenever spouse or child related, be capitalized in one or various lump sum in your jurisdiction, as it is the case in England or Wales? No, it cannot. Maintenance, if we speak about generally maintenance, it's not possible, as it needs to be paid in regular monthly payments. There might be exceptions in terms of putting apart for, let's say, some sort of pension or insurance or these cases, but the idea is that the entitled person needs the money for their regular ongoing to cover their regular ongoing expenditures. So that means the only case where there might be a lump sum or a one-off payment would be the ex-spousal maintenance, which it enables when there's an agreement between the ex-spouses that they would clear the maintenance obligation by a lump sum. So that's the only case where it could be dealt with this way. But generally, it needs to be paid. Normally, it's in monthly installments.
And the second one?
Yes. Would you agree with the statement that spousal support for the period after divorce is intended to compensate for the disadvantages that the marriage has on the earning capacity of the support creditor only? So the ex-spousal maintenance in the Czech Republic would be just an amount to help to the ex-spouse who would somehow be put into not that favorable position after divorce, to help him or her to recover after divorce, to regain his, let's say, independence, his professional capacities, and anything that he or she may have lost during the course of marriage because of the marriage, even though it was from their free will. But basically, it has a causal link with the marriage. So this would be the purpose. And that's why it's so limited, because it means that we're trying to, not us, but the civil code is trying to encourage every ex-spouse to no longer depend on their ex-spouse, but sort of to restart their life with their own, basically, qualification and being responsible for their own life financially.
Thank you.
So, thank you.
Sarah, now it's your turn. Please go ahead.
Well, I'll try and be as quick as I can. But I wanted to kind of give you a flavor of where Ireland's coming from in terms of its approach to maintenance. So a man always had a common law duty to maintain his wife, but he only had a moral duty to maintain his children. And in 1964, we brought in an act called the Guardianship of Infants Act, which for the first time allowed a parent to apply to the court looking for maintenance for a dependent child. And since then, we've had a lot of legislative changes. In 1976, that introduced an act that allowed a parent to look for maintenance for themselves, a spouse, and simultaneously to look for maintenance for a child. We've come a long way since then. There's a legal responsibility on spouses and civil partners to maintain each other. There's a legal responsibility on parents, whether they're married or unmarried, to maintain their children. And that's dependent children, and I'll come back to that. And then we also have, separate to yourselves in the Czech Republic, we have rights for cohabitants since 2010. Once a cohabitant can show that they are an economically qualified cohabitant, they're then eligible to seek compensatory maintenance. And I'll just touch on that a little bit. They have to be qualified cohabitants, they have to be living together for 2 years and have children, or if they don't have children of the relationship, they have to be cohabiting for 5 continuous years in order to be a qualified cohabitant. And then on top of that, they have to prove to the court that they're an economically dependent cohabitant in order for them to be able to seek any financial relief. And that financial dependence either arises from the relationship of cohabitants or from the ending of that relationship. So I would suspect that many of those cases are going to fall into the latter, where the economic dependence arises because the relationship has now come to an end. Our 1976 Maintenance Act is framed in a very negative way, in the sense that it says that the court can make an order where it appears on the application of a parent of the child that the other parent has failed to provide maintenance for the child. So that means that the maintenance payer in the circumstances cannot apply under that act for an order against him or herself. But when it comes to judicial separation cases of spouses and divorce cases of spouses, the maintenance payer, equally as the maintenance payee, could apply to the court to look for an order against him or herself, directing the amount of maintenance they have to pay. We can also agree maintenance, obviously, without going to court, and then we can look to have a maintenance agreement made an order of the court, again under the 1976 Act, and that could be an agreement in relation to a child born outside of marriage or a spouse and a child born inside of marriage. And if the court feels that those agreements are fair and reasonable and adequately protects the interests of the parties and the dependent child, it can make that agreement an order of court, giving it the benefit of enforceability as a court order in the future if there was an issue. And what would be fair and reasonable is generally understood to be an agreement that allows for review. I think we're a bit different to other jurisdictions in that we don't taper our maintenance, generally speaking. We don't like clean break. We don't have provision for clean break in Irish law. It's been said by the Court of Appeal to be a desirable outcome, but it isn't usually available to the courts in most cases unless they're very high value cases. So what happens is that any maintenance order is in effect going to be an interim order, always open to review. So it's very unlikely that the courts are going to make a lump sum order in lieu of maintenance, unless, as I say, one falls into a category of being a very wealthy case and family coming before the courts. The nature of the payments, they could be obviously periodic payments, such as in the other jurisdictions, weekly, monthly. They can be a set amount per month plus paying additional items, for example, 50% of back to school costs or medical or dental costs, in health insurance and the like. And there can be a lump sum as well. There's also provision in the 1976 Act for a lump sum to be made for incidental expenses around the birth of a child. And if, unfortunately, a child were to pass away, there would also be incidental costs surrounding the funeral of a child. So there can be lump sums for specific reasons, or there could be a general lump sum for a future cost. I'll come back to that later as regards non-marital children, just to make a small comment about that. As I say, capitalized child maintenance would be very rare. Courts would prefer to say, well, look, we'll have a periodic amount, and if there's to be a change of circumstances in the future, we can look and review the maintenance sum at that time, whether upwards or downwards. Similarly, as regards spousal maintenance, We don't really favour spousal maintenance tapering off, as I said, or being a lump sum in lieu of maintenance. If a court deems that a spouse requires support, they will order periodic maintenance, and that will be quite common. Even I think, as Sylvie was saying, maybe when a child is able to go to preschool or school. Here, I think it's a little bit later. I think we're a little bit more paternalistic about that. And really, probably when children exit primary education, so around the age of 12 and upwards, and are more self-sufficient, would a court then put a burden, an overwhelming burden, on the otherwise perhaps stay-at-home or part-time parent, a part-time working parent, to go back to work fully? And I think that that comes from our constitution, which provides in Article 41.2 that the state guarantees to protect the family and recognises that by her life within the home, woman gives to the state a support without which the common good cannot be achieved. And the state should endeavour to ensure that mothers shall not be obliged by economic necessity to engage in labour to the neglect of their duties in their home. Now, I'm sure that most people would reel from that suggestion. It's a very outdated and archaic provision, but it is still in our constitution, and we've had discussion and debate here as to whether that should be removed or amended. There's no doubt that women are facing more and more the expectation that they will go out to the workforce, or if they've taken time out of work to care for children or bring up children, that they will, on a separation or divorce, start to gear up to get back into the workforce by retraining, as some of the other speakers had mentioned. And I think certainly there would be an acknowledgement in some instances that that parent should be given maybe 2 or 3 years, depending on what they need to upskill to do, what their chosen profession or course might be, to enable them to do that. So in that sense, we might have an expectation that the maintenance would cease being paid to that spouse in 2 to 3 years' time, and it would be potentially a fixed order. But generally speaking, in my experience, you'd have to go back to court to ensure that the circumstances have arisen to enable that maintenance order to be vacated and to no longer apply. There's different limits in the different courts. The most accessible court here in this jurisdiction is the district court, but it has a limitation on what it can order in terms of maintenance: €150 per week per child and €500 per week for a spouse. So many people with an expectation to receive a maintenance award higher than that will go to the circuit court or the high court. The circuit court and high court have concurrent jurisdiction to hear separation and divorce cases. The district court doesn't have jurisdiction to do that. So if you're applying for maintenance in simpliciter, you could apply to any of the three courts. If you're applying in the context of a divorce or separation, which is the most common circumstances in which people seek maintenance, you would apply in the circuit court most generally, or in the high court if the assets were high enough to warrant that. Similar to some of the other speakers, obviously, to calculate the amount of maintenance, we do not have a set formula. It's not a mathematical equation. The court has to look at the income and earning capacity of both parties, the financial resources of each of them and their children, other responsibilities that they may have to another child, for example, if it's an unmarried situation. They will look at the standard of living enjoyed by the family concerned prior to the proceedings being instituted in the cases of separation and divorce. So I've set out in the paper, which will be uploaded later, the different criteria that apply. But I think there's a general expectation in the courts here for the majority of our separating and divorcing couples is that there will be a diminution in their financial, their standard of living and their financial circumstances by virtue of the separation. So the standard of living enjoyed prior to separation isn't necessarily going to guarantee them a set standard of living post-separation. A spouse can apply for themselves even after divorce. So an ex-spouse can apply for maintenance from his or her ex-spouse, so long as the applicant hasn't remarried. So if I divorce my husband, my first husband, and he remarries, I can still apply for maintenance against him. But of course, the court will take into account that his new spouse may be a dependent on him, or he may have other dependents in terms of children. But I'm not prohibited simply because we're divorced from applying for maintenance for myself. And I have the right to apply. Whether I'll succeed in that application remains to be seen. As I mentioned earlier, I was going to come back to what's an eligible and dependent child. That's a child under the age of 18 years, or if they're in a full-time third level course of education, that could be up to the age of 23. Once that child hits the age 23, if their birthday, for example, is the 12th of June, and they're, or if I pick 12th of March, and they're still in a course of education, the maintenance payer can, on the 12th of March, simply stop the payment and doesn't have to commit to paying it out to see the end of the academic year. You'd like to think that most parents wouldn't cut their child off in those circumstances, but potentially they could. Mostly the maintenance is paid to the other spouse who has the primary care or day-to-day care of that child. But obviously when you have a child going to college, maybe over the age of 18, it could be an order that the maintenance amount be paid to the child directly or to the third level institution to cover fees for that child. What the judge endeavours to do in most cases is to take the reasonable needs and outgoings of both the payer and the payee, and obviously any children, taking into account all the available sources of funds, whether it's income, trust money, state benefits, and so on. They rarely, in my experience, nowadays, they're kind of, as Roxanne was saying, moving away from this idea of spouses who can simply walk away where maybe they've no children in the relationship and they're young, maybe, and the marriage has been short. That is a very rare instance to see spousal maintenance being ordered. Even where there might be a difference between their relative income, so if one spouse is earning 100,000 a year and the other is earning 60,000 a year, a judge will not necessarily go near that and split the difference between them to make sure they have the exact amount as each other post separation or divorce. They'll look to see, does the each of the spouses have the ability to support him or herself post separation or divorce from their own independent sources? And if they can, the fact that one party has a better lifestyle is not going to result in a maintenance order, in my experience. If a person is able to work under the age of maybe 65 and has the capacity to work and physically is able and not disabled, well, then they will be expected, in my experience, to go back to work. I think Roxanne mentioned, you know, about female judges being harder maybe on applicants for maintenance. Certainly, there's a huge amount of female judges hearing family law cases. They're out at work and have been practicing barristers and solicitors. And I think there's a general expectation in society now that women can hold down a job and care for their children, and it's not either or. The maintenance order will end on the death of the payer and the payee, or the cessation of dependency of the child, or indeed the death of the child. But there otherwise usually isn't an end date. So it doesn't specify this order will last for 5 years. As I mentioned earlier, the court will otherwise expect you to come back and seek a review if you're saying there's a change in circumstances. And this really highlights the interim nature of these orders, that a court is not going to mandate for what might happen in 4, 5, 6 years' time. It says, well, you'll have to come back to me and I can assess it based on the circumstances that exist at that time. And I can't crystal ball gaze and see what that's going to look like now, so I'll have to wait and assess it then. Each party, just to quickly say, has a duty of disclosure. That means disclosing their assets, their income, their outgoings, and backing that up with paperwork, their payslips, their bank statements, before a court is going to assess the application for maintenance, or even indeed a review of maintenance. Last thing I'll say is just in relation to how we treated non-marital children versus marital children. We in this office took a case to the ECHR in E versus Ireland a number of years ago, because we were involved in a case where the circuit court judge made a decision that the father of an unmarried child, a child born outside of marriage, was to pay to the mother of that child a periodic maintenance and a lump sum to provide for the accommodation needs of the child, the mother not being able to provide that on her own resources. And that was appealed by the father to the High Court. And in the High Court, the judge decided that the sections in the Act, essentially, and one of the Acts, the 1964 Guardianship of Infants Act, didn't apply to children outside of marriage. And effectively, he set aside the lump sum provision for accommodation, which could have been made for a marital child and regularly would be made available for a marital child in separation and divorce cases. And we took a case to the ECHR claiming that our client's rights under Article 6, 8 and 14 had been violated. And ultimately, the state entered into a settlement with us, acknowledging that the decision of the High Court gave rise to a situation incompatible with the rights of the mother to respect for her family life and private life, and the prohibition of discrimination as regards the enjoyment of those rights and freedoms set out in the Convention under Article 14. She got a non-pecuniary damage amount of €12,000 between her and her child. She got some costs for the case and costs for the domestic Irish proceedings. And basically, and most importantly, the outcome of that was not a monetary award and never is with the ECHR. What it was is that the state had committed then to modernise and reform outdated elements of Irish law, which it subsequently did by an amendment which came in 2015 under what we call the Children and Family Relationships Act, which specifically inserted back into a Family Law Act of 1995 a provision that where a court makes a lump sum order in favour of a child, the court can specify the manner in which or the purpose for which that payment is to be applied. And it says specifically, including providing suitable accommodation for the child to whom the order relates. So it would be hoped that as a result of that amendment, that now the child born outside of marriage could have the opportunity for a lump sum provision for accommodation to be made for him or her, where prior to that, you were lucky if the other party agreed it. But in that instance, in that case, the High Court effectively overturned what the Circuit Court had made provision for. So I hope that that's a useful whistle-stop tour through Irish law. I'll just look at the questions.
Thank you, Ciara. But sorry, we are running out of time. And we have one question to you, but depends on how the last panelist, Talina, would be presenting her speech. We will have or will not have a question to reply. So, Talina, we are hearing you.
I'm ready. The subjects of my report, Alimony for Adult Children in Ukraine, Legislative Guarantees and Judicial Approach. Like in most European countries, Ukrainian parents are obliged to support their children up to the legal age of their majority. Generally, all minors persons up to 18 years old are entitled to maintenance alimony. At the same time, in Ukraine, even adults, persons over 18 years old who continue their education may request alimony from their parents. This right may be executed until a person reaches the age of 23. However, contrary to maintenance of minors, which is imperative for parents, maintenance of adults who continue their education may become obligatory for their parents only if they have an appropriate level of income. Alimony recovery for an adult may be voluntary or compulsory. Voluntary procedure based on the notarized agreement. Compulsory procedure based on the court decision. Thus, upon compulsory procedure, the parent with whom the adult child resides, or the adult child himself, may apply to the court with a claim on collection of alimony during the period of study. The court determines the amount of alimony in a fixed amount or in a share of a pair's income. The applicant chooses the method of recovery at his discretion. Usually alimony in a fixed amount are determined when the pair's income is unstable. If the pair has a regular income, then the alimony is determined proportionally to his or her income. This rule is similar for maintenance of minors and adults within compulsory court procedure. Although Ukraine belongs to the Romano-Germanic legal system, judicial practice and legal conclusions of the Supreme Court play an important role in application of laws. During the past few years, the Supreme Court has issued important legal narratives within the case on alimony recovery for adults, which shall be taken into consideration by lower instance court in further similar cases. In the resolution dated February 8, 2018, the Supreme Court declared alimony recovery by the code for the period of education, the duration of which may vary. In particular, expulsion from the university on upon another ground, and shall be controlled enforcement proceedings. The period established by the code for alimony recovery up to 23rd birthday is preclusive and aims to protect the right of the defendant in the case of continuation of education by the child after reaching the age of 23. Thus, the Supreme Court explained that the age of 23 is the maximum age for alimony recovery based on continuing of education. However, under certain circumstances, for example, expulsion from the university, an adult may lose the right to maintenance beforehand. In this case, parents may continue to maintain the adult children or only voluntarily. In the resolution dated February 25th, 2020, the Supreme Court declared, if an adult needs financial support in connection with education up to the age 23, family law provisions regarding additional expenses for the child maintenance do not apply to this legal relations. Thus, upon reaching 18 years, a person is entitled only to alimony recovery. However, non-additional expenses may be recovered in favor of an adult. The special right may be executed only in favor of minors. In the resolution dated April 17, 2018, the Supreme Court recognized the conclusions made by lower instance courts that during part-time studying, the adult plaintiff has the opportunity to work and earn for a living, which release his parents from obligation to maintain him. Thus, the Supreme Court confirmed that adults who continue education have the right to receive financial support from their parents, regardless of the form of education, part-time or full-time, and regardless of such adults' ability to support themselves during studies. In the resolution dated November 8, 2018, the Supreme Court declared, then determining the adult necessity to maintenance, the court shall take into account all sources of his or her income, the obligation of both parents to provide appropriate financial support and their ability to provide it. Therefore, one of the elements which shall be proven within the case on adult's alimony recovery is such adult's necessity for maintenance based on his or her level of income. In the resolution dated September 23, 2018, the Supreme Court declared, the defendant is not relieved of the obligation to pay alimony during his adult child's vacation period, since such time is included in the period of education. Thus, an adult person's entitled for alimony shall receive it, particular during vacation period of education. In the resolution dated 2020, the Supreme Court declared, failure to provide any evidence to prove the circumstances that would indicate that an adult needs financial assistance in connection with education. Incurring the cost of food, travel, accommodation, purchase of textbooks may be ground for denial or satisfaction a statement of claim. Thus, the Supreme Court explained that the burden of proving the need for maintenance in connection with education is imposed on the plaintiff. All above mentioned conclusions of the Supreme Court show that parents' obligation to support their children who continue education after reaches the age of 18, regardless of the form of education, arises from the combination of the following legal facts. The children ages between 18 and 23, the adult children continue education, the adult necessity for maintenance in connection with education, the parents' financial ability to provide such support. Parents shall be able to work and have a level of income, which allows them to support themselves and their adult children during education. Separately, it should be noted that the court decision on alimony recovery for minors may not be automatically prolonged, then the minor reaches the age of 18 and continuing education. In such situation, such adult child or one of the parents may apply to the court with a new claim for alimony recovery based on the fact on continuing education. Thus, Ukraine's family legislation related to the issue of children's financial support is rather liberal. In Ukraine, adult persons between age of 18 and 23 who continue their education may request for financial support from their parents. Such a possibility has a positive impact on the quality of Ukraine higher education, because while receiving alimony, the student may be deeply involved into education process, rather than to be bothered by his financial status. Of course, the best way to deal with the issue of alimony is to conclude an authorized agreement on the mutually beneficial terms. However, if no agreement can be reached, the adult child right for alimony may be protected by court. Judicial practice confirms that upon properly prepared claim, the court usually issues decision in favor of the plaintiff alimony recipients. In most European countries, the duration of formal child support payments and when the child turns 18. However, this period can be extended until children finish full-time education. The age limit for student support varies from country to country. For instance, in UK, parents continue paying until the age of 20. In Germany and France, until 25. In the US, until 21. In my opinion, Ukraine approach in the regard is quite reasonable and is a soft or golden mean. If you have any questions, I am ready to answer. Problem.
No. Actually, we have Tina. We have no question for the audience, at least for the time being. Oh no, we have. Lina, who brings the application for maintenance? Lina, can you hear me? The question came from Derek.
Repeat, please.
Yeah, the question came from Derek Parsons, and the question is, who brings the application for maintenance? Is it the parent of the child?
Adult. It's a child, one and the parents. Adult child or one of the parents.
Okay, thank you to Lina for that interesting presentation, and we have only 5 minutes for closing remarks, which I would like to use to say thank you to the panelists, and it was really very interesting to hear the recent trends, where we now, where we going, and what is going to change right now. And again, we have a lot of in common between it among our countries, like for example needs or standard of living, as it needs, as it called in UK, or standard of living, as it called in Ireland and Czech Republic, is really depend a lot on the discretion of the judge. And we have no, in that countries have no formulas, no limits, no restrictions. And this is like what we have in Ukraine, by the way, the same, what we really have in common. Or, for example, I would like to mention the trend, like Roxanne admitted, that now we have the situation where the ladies start to earn more than gentlemen, and which means that the change of the normal roles of spouses. But at the same time, I was really surprised to hear about that. For example, the in Ireland, the support, financial support of the kids, since recently started to change from the moral obligation of the parents to their obligation by law. Or, for example, in Czech Republic, which I think it's quite an opposite situation, that in Czech Republic there is no age limit to demand children financial support. Again, we are a lot of very similar in a lot of issues, and in a lot of issues quite opposite. Again, a common law and a continental law countries, but in all that was really very interesting. And to before I pass my or the, I pass the stage to Rachel. I think Rachel, are you here? I would like to mention to you, because I was thinking what could I do, speaking about the more than 100 of people audience, what I could do to make them remember the name of the author of the first constitution in the world. So his name was Filip Orlik, which is actually very Ukrainian native name. Filip, actually the name, which is Filip, is easy to remember. And Orlik is, you know, I'm sure everyone knows, in very, very famous airport in France, actually in Paris, which is called Orly.
Orly, yep.
Orly. Actually, Orly was, this airport was named in the, after Gregory Orly, who was the son of the Philip.
Really?
Yeah, he escaped, escaping from the war in Ukraine, he escaped to France, and he was a great diplomat, and military general, and a person very close to Ludwig XV. Actually, he is a person Ludwig trusts a lot in. And that's why Orly is, I think it's easy to remember, together with Philip. And I really, this is just a fact. No, I think a few people in the world know, but we can be proud of that very famous sense of Ukraine.
Definitely. And,
but thank you for naming that.
Well, I'm glad that I picked that top fact or top tip, because one of the other ones was that apparently you have the third most popular McDonald's in the world.
Yeah.
It's not quite as good as you have the first ever, the author, Filip Orlik, of the first ever constitution.
Yay!
So, Oksana, thank you so much for organising that session for us. And thank you all for participating. It was absolutely fantastic. And we've thoroughly enjoyed having you.